Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. We got a great show today. And today, as a special thing for everybody, this is my 100th show. That's right, my 100th show on Mental Health Matters. And mental health does matter. Your mental health matters. Because if your mental health isn't what you want it to be, it affects your brain. It affects your body. It affects who you are. If your mental health isn't what you want, it doesn't matter anything else. It's sort of like when you start losing your mind, nothing else matters. But that doesn't mean if we're not taking care of our body, that our mind could be okay. We have to be in sync. Anyways, I am so glad you are with us today. Today is my 100th show. Woohoo! All right. And today's guest is Dr. Bill Sands, a professor here at Maharishi University of Management. And he's got a really interesting thing to talk to us about today, apart from a couple of books that he's published and a number of other things. Dr. Sands, tell us about yourself and tell us what we're going to be talking about today.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. What I'd like to talk about is two things, really Maharishi Vedic science, which is what I teach here at the university, and also yoga philosophy. Yoga is very, very popular in the world today. You can't go anywhere without seeing a yoga studio or a yoga paraphernalia. There are hundreds of thousands of yoga websites. And I wanted to talk about the unique insights of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and how that relates to improving one's mental health. It's a very, very important and very powerful technology for helping with mental health issues. And I wanted to discuss them in light of Maharishi's interpretation of yoga.
Wow, that's fantastic. And again, you know, it's really interesting who listens to this podcast, because sometimes people are listening are meditators in the Fairfield community. Sometimes they're people who used to meditate or don't meditate. And then there's sometimes people who will never meditate, who have lots of misconceptions about what's going on. And there's lots of people outside the community, outside literally throughout the world, that are listening to this. You could be anywhere in the world right now listening to this. And you might think you understand yoga, but now let's really get to what it really means. So thanks, Bill. So tell us about where we're going to go.
Well, as I was saying just a second ago, yoga is understood throughout the world. It's very popular. And yet there are fundamental misconceptions. Yoga we usually think of as physical exercises, postures, breathing exercises, maybe some meditation mixed in. The postures are called asanas for those who practice or familiar with it. The breathing exercises are called pranayama. And these are done in order to, for a large variety of reasons. Some people do it for fun and for fitness, to keep trim, to keep the body in good shape. Others for health reasons. Others even for spiritual development. But there's a very, very important component of yoga that is generally lost. You can find some traces of it here and there, some obscure website here and there. But most people think of it pretty much in terms of these fundamental elements. Yoga, however, the word is derived from a Sanskrit root. The root is yuj, Y-U-J, and it means to join, to combine, to put together. And yoga means union. It means a state where something is put together. Now, what is it that's put together? The individual, our individual awareness, what we understand as ourselves, our thinking process, our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings, our aspirations, our hopes, our dreams, our disappointments, all of that, that we can think of as the individual self. But deep within each of us is what you could say is an unbounded field of pure intelligence, pure creativity, pure happiness, pure fulfillment. It's kind of a cliche in the world that there's a source of inner silence, inner peace, and yet it's really there, and what is needed is a means to tap into it. And this is what the Transcendental Meditation Program of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi does. It allows an individual to settle deep within and to experience this inner self, and then to come out and bring those qualities with them. Now, when an individual is experiencing that inner self, what essentially happens is that the individual awareness expands and expands and identifies itself with this inner self, because the inner self is really just that. It's our own self. It's our own nature. It's the most fundamental level of our inner being. And when we experience that, then we are experiencing what is called traditionally in the Sanskrit literature surrounding yoga practice, we are experiencing a state of yoga. In modern yoga philosophy, generally, it's very difficult to pin any one definition of yoga down, but there's this sense among those who aspire to higher states of consciousness, higher levels of awareness, that if you practice yoga, if you act in a way that's harmonious and beneficial to yourself and to the environment, if you do good things, if you take on an attitude of fulfillment, perhaps if you give away at least some or most of your possessions, if you do all these things and then you practice some asanas and you practice some breathing exercises, then someday maybe you will experience that inner state of yoga. What people find when they practice the transcendental meditation technique is that they experience it the first day. It may not be completely clear. It may not be that one experiences unbounded, eternal fulfillment. But one experiences it perhaps a little bit more quietly, a little bit for just a fraction of a second. But that grows over time. The experience becomes clearer and clearer. So one essentially starts out with this experience of yoga. It's not a long-term proposition. But the understanding of yoga as the experience of this inner state, as opposed to the performance of physical exercises and breathings, that it's not that it's a misunderstanding that yoga practices such as asanas and pranayamas and physical exercises and postures, those are a part of yoga, absolutely. I'm not suggesting that they are not yoga, they are. But traditionally, they are known to be conducive to having the inner experience. And this may seem like a little bit of philosophical hair splitting, how you define yoga, but it has very, very important implications in terms of yoga philosophy in general, because what happens is that the translators and the commentators of the yoga texts often misconstrue a description of the inner experience of yoga with a practice that one should perform. In other words, they see a verse that describes that inner experience, and they feel that what that verse is really doing is prescribing a way to behave, prescribing an attitude that one should take on. The Yoga Sutras, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, are one of the primary Sanskrit texts that discuss yoga. They discuss yoga philosophy. And yoga is defined in the second sutra. A sutra is a very concise expression, very short. An aphorism, we refer to them in English. And they have these very short aphorisms, and then commentators comment on them and bring out sort of what they feel that sutra is supposed to mean. The second sutra of Patanjali describes yoga. And it goes like this: yogas citta vritti nirodha. That's the Sanskrit expression. And almost every translation of this sutra says that yoga is the stilling of the mind. It's a process of making the mind quiet. It's the process of pushing out all mental activity. And so one would naturally think when reading an English translation or a translation in any other language that the way to perform yoga is to push thoughts out of the mind, to create some effort, to try to make the mind a blank, whatever. If you go online, you can see many, many meditations where you're asked to force the mind to move in a particular direction. But what Maharshi described with this sutra is that it's actually describing a state. What it says is that yoga is the complete settling of the activity of the mind, of mental activity. In other words, it's a state where the thoughts, the feelings, the intuitions spontaneously become quiet, and one experiences that deep inner self.
Okay, so let me ask you a question.
Sure.
So some people have this great experience. They meditate and they have this great experience. Some people never have a good experience. Some people, you know, just like they exercise and they never feel comfortable exercising, or they meditate and it doesn't work for them. Or they have some other misunderstanding of that, you know, I'm supposed to get enlightened. When I'm so stressed out, I can't even function through my day. How does somebody actually know what to do or not to do, or what's the truth for them? Because you hear these grand ideals that you're describing, and you go, well, what's true for me? I mean, maybe I'm living in, you know, Fairfield, I'm in a meditating kind of community, and I do my program, I meditate, and I do this, I do that. But, you know, I've been doing this 30 years, and I'm not enlightened. I'm not, you know, is that the goal? Where am I missing something? Or where are people who are lost like that missing something? Saying that they're lost even is a misunderstanding.
Good, great question. There's a couple of things to say about that. One is, what is it that the person is doing? There are many different types of meditation practices. Brainwave research has shown that there are different effects from different meditations. Most require some kind of concentration or contemplation, some kind of mental effort. And for these, they may have some good effect in some areas, but what they don't allow is for someone to settle down spontaneously and experience that inner self. That's characterized by, as I understand it, I'm not a brain scientist, but as coherent alpha waves. In other words, alpha waves indicate an increased state of alertness, and the coherence indicates if one is experiencing that inner self. Now, if somebody's practicing a technique where they're trying to force out thoughts or force out feelings or trying to make the mind blank or trying to feel peace or trying to feel happiness, that creates mental activity.
Okay.
Again, it might have some effect, some value. I'm not trying to say that
Well, I find, you know, from what I do as a clinician, I find great benefits from other meditative techniques, from, for instance, a mindfulness thing. But I think it often is missing the case. For instance, the thing everybody's probably heard me say before is that if I'm anxious and I'm already in my head too much, being more in my head doesn't get me out of my head. It keeps me trapped in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that the transcendental meditation technique, which, again, many people in Fairfield are doing, is a way to spontaneously do that. But what if it's not? What if I'm doing the right technique, but it's not doing what I need it to do?
Well, there's a couple things to say about that. One is, if someone is practicing transcendental meditation, they feel they're not getting the benefits, the very first thing to do is to have their meditation checked by a teacher, by a trained teacher. And the reason for that is that the technique itself requires effortlessness. And it's very, very simple, very easy to do, but it's very easy to not do it properly. And so if one gets their meditation checked, that will ensure proper practice. And as a teacher of transcendental meditation, I've found many, many times people come in and say they're not getting benefits, they're not having good effects. And I check their meditation, and they go away very happy and satisfied. So that's one thing. The other thing is, what happens during meditation is two things. The awareness goes inward, but at the same time, when the awareness quiets down, the body becomes deeply rested and begins to release stress. Stress, you can, in a general sense, is any kind of physiological impediment to the smooth functioning of the nervous system. And one gets that deep rest, then it can create some kind of activity in the mind and the body, and that appears as though one is, in a sense, you might feel like, well, this is very superficial. I'm not going deep within. I want to go deep within myself, but I'm feeling very superficial. But as one will find in the course of instruction, that's actually fine too, because there are two things that one has to do. One has to experience the inner self, but one has to purify the physiology. And it's the purification of the physiology that allows the inner self not just to be experienced during meditation, but to be experienced outside of meditation, so that the inner qualities of peace, happiness, fulfillment, and all of those begin to be expressed in the outer life. And what's most significant is not necessarily what you're experiencing inside during meditation, because there are a variety of different experiences that are related to one's own physiology. But how do you feel during the day? Do you feel more calm? Do you feel more relaxed? Do you feel more easy? Do you feel more peaceful? That's what is most important, because that is an indication of the growth of consciousness. That's an indication of getting the benefits and the results. We don't practice transcendental meditation just for the sake of sitting, you know, in a comfortable state for 20 minutes. We practice for the sake of, what does it do for your activity?
So people sometimes forget that. By the way, you're listening to Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry. You are listening to our 100th episode, so thank you for joining in today. And today we're talking with Dr. Bill Sands regarding yoga. And what I want to get to is that for some people, we're saying sometimes this doesn't work, okay? And that's understandable. But sometimes there's also something else that's missing, such as an understanding, like that I should, there's this emphasis, I should be enlightened, I should be correct, I shouldn't think a negative thought, and now I've got to push away negative thoughts. I shouldn't, you know, the shoulds and shouldn'ts in our lives. And then we get lost in, oh, we're going to have an episode sometime on conspiracy theories, but on, you know, this is wrong, this is, you know, and I'm bad. And they start beating themselves up, or they start feeling betrayed by this group or whatever it is, because they're not having their experiences that they wish that they had. So sorry to be devil's advocate, but I want to come out with, you know, people are stressed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's missing here?
I want to say one thing, and maybe this will be helpful. I learned transcendental meditation 46 years ago at this point. I was a sophomore at Georgetown University. And one of the reasons I learned was because I had a very severe problem with depression. I was very, very depressed, as many college students are. And so this really relates to the health issues here and the mental health issues here. Mm-hmm. And I learned transcendental meditation. And it's not as though it went away overnight. It's not as though I took a course, I practiced TM, and it went away. But over time, what I found was it just got better and better. There were longer periods between the episodes. It became less deep. It became less profound.
So the TM technique worked for you.
Very much
so. But again, for some people, what are they missing? So maybe, yes, they need to get their meditation check. Maybe, yes, you need to do something else, you know, get your meditation, go to Lark at the Information Center or Amy. They're wonderful over there. There's lots of great people it's free for the rest of your life. But there's also some understandings, I think, as we were talking about yoga, that's also, there's these misunderstandings. What are the misunderstandings that people are having?
Well, I think one misunderstanding is, see the thing is, when you talk about, you know, should I be pushing out my negative thoughts? Should I be feeling this way or feeling that way?
Yeah.
Or we never prescribe how one should think. And the reason is because the effects of this meditation should take place spontaneously and automatically. We teach prisoners in prisons to practice transcendental meditation. We never tell them, now when you go out, be a good person, don't steal, don't break laws or anything like that. But what we find is that they don't come back to prison. They don't break laws as much. It's a process that the benefits come over time.
Okay.
And the same thing,
but that's,
I think,
for the meditation. But what about the yoga philosophy? What is being missed on the yoga philosophy?
I'm not sure if I get your question.
So for yoga philosophy, people interpret, mm-hmm. right, this philosophy where this meditation comes from.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they're misinterpreting.
Oh, yeah.
And they're saying, don't think negative thoughts. Don't. I should, you know, be enlightened by doing this, and all I have to do is let go.
Yeah.
You know, aren't I letting go? I'll try harder to let go. No, I'm not supposed to try harder. Wait, no, I'm now doing the wrong thing by trying to do the wrong thing, by trying to do the right thing, and I get lost in my head. Or, oh, I'm a prison person, so I'm thinking I want to kill somebody. And it's like, okay, I shouldn't be thinking that. So you're going to read something from the Gita here for a second.
Yeah, I want to read a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is an ancient Sanskrit text. It is one of the core texts of yoga philosophy.
Got it.
And I want to read a verse, and then I'm going to tell you how it's usually understood, and then I want to tell you what Maharshi's interpretation is. And I think this is relevant to what you're saying.
Got it. Please.
the verse says, and this is in the fourth chapter, it says, text is part of a conversation between a teacher and a student. And the teacher is saying, having cast off attachment to the fruit of action, ever contented, depending on nothing, even though fully engaged in action, he does not act at all. So the common modern translation interpretation, and by modern I really mean anything within the last few thousand years probably, okay, is that one should adopt an attitude of not having attachment, of not being attached to the fruits of action. In other words, one should adopt an attitude that, yes, I'm doing my work today, but I don't care how it really turns out. I don't care if it's successful or not successful. I don't care if I'm praised or if I'm despised. I also have an attitude of always being contented and depending on nothing, and just creating what you could say is a mood or an idea that I should behave this way or I should behave that way. Even though fully engaged in action, I do not act at all. So this is what we often refer kind of lightly as mood making. Mm. In other words, taking on an attitude that influences your behavior. And it's not natural. It's not natural to give away your possessions or to engage in activity but not care what happens, to not care whether you're successful or not successful. And the way Maharshi comments on this verse is by saying that really what this is doing is describing a higher state of consciousness, a higher state of consciousness that may take some people many years to achieve. But it's a natural state. It's a state where the stress has been eliminated from the nervous system, and that one not tries to feel contented, but one naturally feels contented. One doesn't try to feel fulfilled in life, but one is naturally fulfilled. One always cares whether one is successful or a failure, but if one is very, very fulfilled inside as a natural state of life, then, you know, the relative successes and fulfillments don't make you crazy. You know, they don't make you unhappy. They don't make you depressed. You don't get bent out of shape. You feel like, well, I guess I didn't do well on that one. But it's not something that's going to destroy your life and send you into a tailspin.
It's an interesting thing you start talking about non-attachment, because there's certainly a distinction between Buddhist perspective and an Indian perspective and maybe an American perspective of what attachment is. And I could say I almost have a philosophy as a therapist where I start talking to people about don't be attached to the fruit of your action, be attached to doing what you're here to do. We call it dharma. Yeah. I guess you could describe that better than I can, obviously. But it's sort of like, you're here to do what you're here to do. Focus on what you need to be doing, not how it's received by the other, your partner or your boss or your child, or you're here to be and do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. So how would you describe this non-attachment from these different perspectives? Is that a good question?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. Two things. First thing I want to emphasize is we would never say don't see a therapist if you need to see a therapist.
Okay.
And as a therapist, you do what you have to do and what you're trained to do. And I would never say to someone, no, don't do that, just meditate. If you need therapy, have therapy. If you need to see a psychiatrist, see a psychiatrist. If you need to see a family doctor, see a family doctor.
Right.
So absolutely. So nothing I say would interfere I would want to interfere with anything that you say to somebody in the confines of their practice.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of Buddhism, this is sort of I would personally distinguish, I'm not an expert in Buddhism, but I have studied it in college and so forth. I would distinguish between what is understood in modern times about Buddhism and what was actually the ancient practice of Buddhism. And the same thing is true with Indian thought. In India, there's much more of a tendency to go with the modern interpretations, such as the one I just read. They feel the same way that, for the most part, philosophically, that you have to act in a certain way, you have to behave in a certain way, you have to push out attachments and all of that. And that's a major part of Buddhism. But I think it's what I would call a path versus goal mistake.
Mm.
And that is the ancient Buddhist texts, which really themselves don't date back to Buddha himself. There was a long period of time between Buddha himself and the texts of Buddhism, which were written by his his disciples many, sometimes hundreds or thousands of years later. They really created the philosophy of Buddhism. Buddha didn't create the philosophy of Buddhism.
Oh, interesting.
He taught, and I would be willing to bet that what happens is the same thing as what happened with the Bhagavad Gita. It's describing the goal, not the path. And sometimes the path erroneously is taken to be the goal. Now, mindfulness is an example of that. Mindfulness, I haven't studied it, so you could catch me on some points. Okay. But ultimately, it's describing, it comes from a description of what should be a state of more enlivened awareness and trying to emulate that state. Mm. And emulating the state is different from having the state. It's like if you're driving to New York, thinking about, New York, and imagining what Fifth Avenue looks like as you're driving up 95, that's not going to get you to New York. You have to, that's the path. You have to drive along Route 95 from Washington, D.C., and you have to follow the road signs. You have to go over the right bridges. You follow the path, and then you get to the goal. And the same thing is true with these kinds of experiences, which people think are telling them how to behave, but they're not. They're describing the goal. The path is very simple. You meditate, and then you go about your daily life, and the effects of the meditation come spontaneously. And what is felt to be non-attachment, what is felt to be fulfillment, what is felt to be peace and happiness, that grows automatically and spontaneously. If you try to make a mood of, oh, I'm feeling so happy and content today, and somebody just fired me, but I don't care because, you know, you'll starve to death probably. It's just like
There's reasons to get angry in this life.
Yes, sometimes.
There's reasons to be upset. There's reasons. In this town, there was a bunch of suicides, and I was very upset at what had happened. We had talked about this earlier.
Yes.
And I'm upset at how the community reacted and how people react, and I want people to live. I'm very upset at the election because I see very much a lot of dangers, and I'm wanting people to be looking to the next stage of growth.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's reason to be angry, but the question is not, are you angry? The question is, what am I doing with that anger? The question isn't even what's the goal, but how am I going to get there? It's like, let's get to the bigger questions, right? And let's stop with the, oh, I'm not supposed to have negativity. No, have negativity, feel that. But then what do you want to create from that?
Yeah.
And do you want to create more negativity and dig your hole deeper? Or do you want to get out of that?
And maybe not express it all the time. You know, when you have negativity, maybe you don't want to go spreading negativity everywhere. But negativity is just a physiological thing. It's something that takes place in the physiology. There is a branch of Vedic science. Vedic science, Maharshi Vedic science, is the study of consciousness and how it grows. And very quickly, there's a whole branch called Maharshi Ayurveda. Mm. And Ayurveda seeks to balance the body. It seeks to balance the physiology through herbal remedies and all of these different things. I don't have time to go through them now. But often when people are having difficulties, they're meditating and they feel like, but I still have this physical problem, or I still feel negativity or too much anger or something like that, we recommend take advantage of that. It helps a lot.
Or whatever your path is. Again, find your path, I think, is what you're saying. Don't focus on the goal. See the goal. See the goal of being enlightened or whatever your goal is. But find a path and realize that path is literally a path. It changes every moment. It changes. And find that balance for you today at this moment. Is that how you'd say it?
Yeah, I think that's a very good summation.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bill. Thank you so much for coming today. And I really want you to come back again. And we're going to do another show more explicitly on the Gita and some of these other books that you've written. Because what are the books you've written, by the way, before we head out?
Two books. One is called Maharshi Mahesh Yogi and His Gift to the World, which tells all about transcendental meditation and all of the advanced programs of Maharshi Vedic Science.
Okay.
And the other is called Maharshi's Yoga, The Royal Path to Enlightenment. And that discusses yoga philosophy from Maharshi's perspective. And there's some very interesting things about Ashtanga yoga and Karma yoga
and
Jnana yoga.
Okay, well, thank you. I actually really am interested in getting that book. So everyone have a great day. Thank you so much for joining us on Mental Health Matters. Bye, everyone.
Thank you, Scott, very much.